Hello and welcome to Real Bible Stories. Join us as we deep dive into the historic, religious, cultural, political, and emotional context surrounding the real lives of real people in the Bible and the stories we've all grown to love. Welcome back to Real Bible Stories. I'm your host, Imran Ward, and I'm joined by my wife, Selena.
Hello.
And our teacher, Ryan Brown.
Welcome back, everyone.
So we are continuing down the rabbit hole even further, down the path even further, as we have yet another parable that was taught by Jesus during his ministry. So this week, I hope you're enjoying these, by the way. Please give us some feedback. If you see us at church, if you are on the church Facebook page, like, give us some feedback on if you're enjoying what we're talking about, or if you have some recommendations or ideas or thoughts about what you'd like us to talk about, because that stuff's important too. So, but this week we're continuing down with another parable, parable of the 10 virgins. So if you haven't heard it before, it's not what you think, but I hope you'll enjoy as we get it started today. And Ryan, do you have a point before we jump into actually the reading?
Yeah, I'll just say this is that I think everybody at this point has appreciated the fact that nothing that we really study is ever just standalone by itself, even the parables, right?
Like, of course,
the parables are still placed where they are within scripture, intentfully, purposefully, to kind of hit a larger theme or point that the author is making. So this parable belongs to a set that really starts back in Matthew chapter 24. But in it, there's really kind of, I guess, five thematic phrases or motifs that are repeated in this set that this parable will hit, but also leading into it. It's the first is that speaking of what we call the parousia, and that is what the second coming of Christ, known as the parousia.
Wait, hold on. Did you know that, Selena? I didn't know that.
I think earlier.
Like earlier today or earlier in life? Yeah, so you learned today.
Earlier in life. I was today years old.
Today years old.
When I learned what parousia is.
Yeah, heard the word parousia and understood that it meant that it's talking about the second coming of Christ.
It's a royal term. So this is a good way to understand, I guess, the way Jesus talks about his second coming is that, and particularly with Luke, but the parousia is when a new king was crowned, right? There was always a capital. There was somewhere that a king ruled from. In Rome's case, they ruled from Rome, right? At the point of Constantine, he ended up moving the Roman Empire's capital from Rome to Constantinople, modern day Istanbul, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then back and forth, right? So what would happen is that there'd be a new emperor, a new king ruling from somewhere. There would be a parousia where if that emperor or king, after being crowned, would go visit another city within his kingdom, they would have the parousia, which would be all his loyal subjects or probably most hardline supporters would go out in front, outside the city, to welcome the king as he enters into the city. So they would go out to him. And
so the parousia is that process of them going out and welcoming the king as he comes into the city.
And then as he enters, they would then fall in behind him and they would enter the city together. Okay. So when we talk about the parousia and the second coming of Christ, that's essentially what is being described in the book of Revelation, which is there's what Paul calls the harpazo, to be caught up, right? To be, in some doctrine terms or theological camps, they call it the rapture. If you're dispensational, you would call it the rapture. But Paul calls it the harpazo. It is being caught up and when Christ returns. But it's all painted as a parousia, which is when the king, the new crowned king, Jesus, returns, those loyal subjects of his, i.e. us believers, meet him out there and return with him and enter the city in his glory. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that is a royal term. Now, when talking about the parousia, particularly within this set, there's like five themes that Jesus speaks of that are common across all events with the parousia. The first is that no one knows the time or the hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, nobody knows when the parousia is going to happen, when Christ comes again. Only the Father knows. No one knows the time. And that this is a relevant anchor to this parable with the 10 virgins, because it gives you insight into what the bridesmaids, i.e. the virgins, knew.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew that he was coming, that the bridegroom would be coming in this parable, but they did not necessarily know when, right? Mm-hmm. Just like nobody knows. And I can just say this point to all my fellow believers out there. If anybody ever tries to convince you that they know when Jesus is coming back, that is a massive red flag, especially if it's being taught from the pulpit. Run, okay?
Turn and run.
Nobody knows, not even Christ. Only God the Father, who is in heaven, knows when this is going to happen. Anybody tries to convince you otherwise, you are more in a cult than anything, and leave, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. Mm-hmm. No, don't try to mathematically, oh, I found the mathematical formula. No, you didn't. You sure didn't.
I stole the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, nobody knows, okay?
You said nobody knows, not even Christ. What do you mean by that? You said just God the Father.
And Christ is saying that from a place of in the flesh, right? So he's okay. So they're asking him, well, when are you coming back? Like, he knew that he had to die, that he was going to be ascend into his throne, right? Ascend into his glory. He knew all these things were going to take place. He just didn't know in his flesh, right? Because he surrendered certain capacities when in the incarnation,
yeah.
Him wrapping himself in flesh, there are certain capacities he gave up. One of those has been, you know, the complete omniscience, right? So everything was spirit led, just as it is for us. We can't know everything. We are spirit led, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with that particular character and nature of Christ being his nature, you know, it's one of those things where they're asking him, well, when are you going to come back? And he says, I don't know. Nobody knows except for God the Father in heaven.
Oh, I see.
Right. So it's speaking more to his human capacity, not his divine, right? Just okay. At that time in the incarnation, in his human capacity, it was not revealed to him. But it shows in this anchor, what it anchors in this parable is what the virgins, the bridesmaids know, okay? The second theme that goes from Matthew 24 through 25 is that the theme to keep watch. And this is anchoring the mission of the bridesmaids, that there is a mission for them to keep watch. They need to be vigilant. They need to be aware and ready, right? It's not, if you think about when Christ was, the night he was arrested in the garden, you'll see some of the associations here, but you know, they go out, he's praying, he comes back, he finds his disciples sleeping,
mm-hmm.
and he wakes him up and he says, you need to keep watch, right? The time is near. And Jesus goes back to praying. So there's this constant theme of to keep watch with that, right? The third is wisdom. And this is interesting. So this anchors really the character of the bridesmaids. There's kind of two characters that are presented in the bridesmaids, the foolish ones and the wise ones. From 24 to 25, in fact, twice, when it's talking about his future parousia, Christ, in both times that he refers to it in Matthew, it's in the context of wisdom and foolishness. In other words, he's like, in those days, here's what it means to be wise. Here's what it means to be foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Much of what this parable is about. The next one is to be prepared and waiting. It anchors the expectation of the bridesmaids, right? Is that you need to be prepared, but also be prepared to wait. That the parousia is a delayed event. It's not going to happen immediately. And then the fifth is the delay itself, which anchors this entire parable. So nothing in this parable would have been relevant to anything we're going to discuss if there wasn't a delay in the bridegroom. Okay. So if the groom wasn't delayed and wasn't late, pretty much the entire problem and resolution and everything that we gather from this parable and this mm-hmm. story is irrelevant, right? So it's really kind of what makes the parable is the delay itself. So don't miss the delay.
So essentially, as we get into it, you want us to focus on these five thematic phrases, which is timing, that no one knows the timing, that we're to keep watch, to be wise, the concept of being prepared and in a state of like waiting, And also that there's going to be a delay. So as we read, that's what you want us to kind of focus on.
Yeah, and I would say just even more simply is the no one knows the time or the hour. That just shows with the knowledge of the bridesmaids that they didn't know. The wisdom piece is the expectation of character. The preparation and the wait is the expectation for action. They need to be prepared, but also in waiting. And that a lot of this is all in the context of a delay, that none of this is going to happen immediately. The last thing I would just say with this is that weddings in these days were, I mean, a wedding even now is one of the most fundamental, biggest things that you can happen in life, right? Mm-hmm. You never forget your wedding day. You never, like that is a very fundamental event. I would argue, though, that back in those days, it was even more so. And the reason why is because just culturally and across society is that, one, weddings are communal in the sense that families come together, but they're not communal in the sense that, like, if we'll just pretend you two weren't married yet, but you decided to get married here in 29 Palms, the entire town of 29 Palms would not show up to your wedding.
Yeah.
There would be no expectation of you to invite them and to your wedding or and give them a bunch of food for a week and a bunch of wine for a week. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was much more tied to community and the strengthening of family than it is now. So with that, like understanding that's not just a big moment in someone's life, but it also kind of represents a separation and a transition from the old into the new, right? So you are leaving your parents' home and starting this life together with somebody else.
Yeah.
And that is new. That is a big change, right? So with that said, all that, what's surrounded with that is that this is probably the most significant life event a person can have, the way they viewed it. Mm. And there's a lot of things that surrounded it in terms of shame and honor and things like that. So
I think
we'll get a little more into that once we read it, but just keep those in mind.
Yeah, I think it would be totally worthwhile to one day do an episode that just talks about Hebrew and Jewish weddings and what those ceremonies mean. Because there's so much in the Bible that talks about bridesmaid, bridegroom, a wedding, that concept of that transition from being without God and then being with Him and being forever with Him, and that, and it's all not always, but pretty consistently described as a marriage, all right? So I think it'd be
we're going to talk a lot about it today, or you get at least a piece of it today, because there's a lot to it, and it is the model that Christ chose to represent His relationship with us. You know, it's not just in terms of relationship, but in terms of covenant.
Yeah.
He follows a marriage covenant model.
And I think it's important just to remember that you shouldn't be bringing your own opinions first into the conversation. Let's take some time to understand how God's defining marriage, how God's defining that covenant and the promises that He expects from that perspective of marriage. Because depending on who you are listening to this podcast, where you grew up and what you've seen throughout your life, people treat marriage very differently, and we're not talking about how other people treat marriage. Mm-hmm. We're talking about how God defines that relationship.
Mm, that's true.
All right. So with that, Selena.
Yeah. So today's reading is from Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish and five were wise. For when the foolish took the lamps, they took no oil with them. But the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour."
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there to unpack. So Where are we starting out?
Well, let's just address the virgin piece here. Oh, why is that significant? So back in those days, the bridesmaids, because remember, it was a communal event, a wedding. It's not like today where you choose kind of you're my maid of honor and you're in, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Then it was really more like, as it was a communal event, but it's the community coming to honor you.
Okay.
So the community would essentially put up like you could end up being a bridesmaid essentially for somebody you don't even know. Right.
That's so strange.
But they had to be virgins on the bride. It had to be somebody like
that's
the bride.
That's interesting. So would you plan your own wedding, or it was something that was kind of planned around you because of the decision that was made?
That was the groom's family's responsibility. The mm-hmm. groom's in particular, like the groom himself but it was practically his family. This plays a very significant role in the wedding at Cana. And we'll be talking about that in a couple few weeks coming up weeks, but
okay,
but yeah, that plays actually a very significant role in that story. But yeah, so the groom's family would be responsible for putting all that on.
I think that's important to think about how, because God doesn't describe himself as the bridesmaid, he described himself as a bridegroom, and we're the bridesmaid, which means we need to understand we're the bride, he's the groom, so we should understand, well, what are his responsibilities?
Except in this parable, we're the bridesmaids. Yeah. That's the thing, is a parable.
But understanding how, this is what I mean with like understanding how the wedding works, helps us understand, well, what does God mean? When, like, what in responsibilities is he saying that he has by describing himself as the groom? And what responsibilities do we have when he describes us as the bride? You know, like.
So there's a whole model. Let's just go through it, right? Is that okay?
Sure.
Couple interesting things, and remember, Christ talks about his relation to us is that we're the bride, he's the groom, right? Mm-hmm. So an interesting element, when you're getting ready to go into a marriage covenant or that process, the father would choose the bride for his son. The son didn't get a say, okay?
Huh.
Now, practically speaking, you know, you could go, you're like, Mama, I really, really like this girl. You know, and mom and dad may be like, all right, son, like, you know what I mean? And they go approach that family for maybe marriage, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of just culturally, legally, right, you know, the dad could very much like, nope, you're not, get her out of your mind. You're going to go marry this girl over here because it'll strengthen our family. And mm-hmm. he doesn't really get a say. What's interesting is that the bride does.
Mm.
So essentially what would happen is the father of the groom would go to the father of the bride and say, I'd like to propose a marriage between my son and your daughter. And what would happen is that the father of the bride would then set a dowry, a price to essentially, you know, it sounds bad, but purchase the bride.
Yeah.
You pay this dowry. And if you know, at the payment of that dowry, you will be able to.
We attach very emotional feelings to a marriage, but like these words have like business connotations. Like we call when businesses like merge together, they can be described as like a marriage.
Well, I want you to notice like, though,
proposal, like proposals are a thing in business, but in a marriage context, like, oh, he proposed, you know, that's very emotional, but like, that's a legit thing as you're describing, like the father would go and make a proposal.
And the marriage would go forward once the dowry is paid. So now notice that when Christ is on the cross, he yells out to tetelestai, which is a legal term, paid in full.
Mm.
What's paid in full? The dowry.
The dowry.
You see what I'm saying? Is a way you can read that. And so once the dowry has been set though, okay, so before it's paid, but it's been agreed upon where he says, if you want to marry my daughter, this is the dowry you need to pay. Once both fathers agree to that, they can go, they go to the proposed bride.
Mm-hmm.
They ask her, he is proposing your hand in marriage. Do you accept or reject it? And she has to verbally, with her mouth, agree to the marriage. Now, I just want you to think about that for a second because much of what are we supposed to do as believers if when we enter into covenant with Christ, we were supposed to confess with our mouth before men.
Yeah.
So in the same way, it's like God saying, here is a marriage proposal with Jesus, do you accept it?
Mm-hmm.
He's already paid the dowry.
It's already paid.
But you have to verbally agree to that, right? With your mouth.
Well, he's already agreed to pay.
I'm saying you as the bride. You have to agree to that marriage. That the bride had a say. She could say no. And she could say, or she could be like, I'm worth a little more than two donkeys. Push that dowry up, right? But either way, she had a say. The son didn't, okay? I found that interesting. So now once the bride agrees to the wedding, they would go both have a mikvah. So you would baptism. They'd get baptized. Mm. So again, once you come to faith in Christ.
When you say baptized, you mean like it's the process of becoming clean, right?
I'm saying actual baptism, a mikvah. You actually go get baptized.
Okay.
You get
dunked in water?
Yeah, immersed in water.
Okay.
They had a lot more mikvahs for
different things
for them than we're kind of like you get baptized once sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's like it was part of ritual cleansing. Every time you go into the temple and visit the temple, you would go through a mikvah. Anytime you enter a covenant, you get baptized. It was much more prevalent then, right?
Okay.
So for this one though, just think about us though. So you verbally confess with your mouth among men that I agree that Christ is Lord, right? You agree to the marriage. Yep. What's the very next thing you're supposed to go do?
Go do a mikvah.
Go get baptized, right? Yep. You see, now go. When Paul believes, confesses Christ as Lord, boom, he says immediately he went out and got baptized. It's following that same covenant model, right? Mm-hmm. So both the bride and the groom would go get baptized. Why do you think Jesus said it was appropriate for him to get baptized? Right? Because even John the Baptist is like, you know, you should be baptizing me. He's like, mm-hmm. for this time it's appropriate. And I want to make it kind of something clear with that though. Because they're like, well, no, he's the high priest going in to do a purification of the temple. Covenants follow a model, right? So if you're going into any sort of covenant, whether it's marriage, business, right, it follows a model. So yeah.
Okay.
All those models include a mikvah, a baptism.
Yep.
Okay. So it kind of applies to all those models. But part of that, though, is that to enter into a marriage covenant, once you both agree on the dowry, you'd go get baptized. So it's almost at this point when Christ starts his ministry is when he starts, or maybe he understands the cost of the dowry he has to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So at that age, you know, at that age, Jesus says, I know the dowry.
And I agree to pay it.
And I agree to pay it. So he moves forward, gets baptized, entering into that covenant. And that's when he begins his ministry in that long road to Jerusalem, to where he pays the dowry on the cross, right? So there's that. After both the mikvah, you would have essentially a betrothal ceremony. And the betrothal ceremony is one where it's kind of like our modern day wedding ceremony. You know, you decorations and you come together and you know, you do all that. The groom would give, but that's essentially like a formal engagement though. It's not a marriage, you're betrothed though. Betrothed, betrothed, mm-hmm. however I say, I always say betrothed, I think is the proper way. But yeah, so you'd have that ceremony. And in that ceremony, the groom would give the bride a symbol or a token, not just of his love, but of a promise that she has his heart and he is coming back for her. Because after that ceremony, they split.
Mm-hmm.
The groom goes and builds a home for them, usually attached to their father's home.
Mm.
So if to you his back, father's home?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you think back to like John, the Gospel of John, there's a point where Christ says, I go to prepare a place for you. And in my father's house, there are many rooms.
Oh, yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So he that's him making an association to, we are betrothed now.
Mm-hmm.
I have to leave because I got to go prepare a place for us because you are the bride. I am the groom.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So in that time,
and I love that the, there are many rooms. It's like, I'm preparing it for like all of
everybody,
mine,
right?
All of mine. Yeah.
So in terms of this model and association that Christ makes, what time are we in? We're in the time of
the betrothal,
right? Mm-hmm. So, this is all leading to something that actually is very relevant to this parable, by the way. So within the middle of that, right, he would give her a token in that time to remember him and remember his love for her, right? So now just think, what does Christ give us that he says, do this in remembrance of me? What is the token? What is the symbol he gives us to remind us of his love for us?
You're talking about the bread and the wine?
Lord's Supper, right?
The Last Supper? Yep.
Lord's Supper, right? Communion. He says, this do in remembrance of me. This you need to do to remember my love for you, that I paid this dowry. This is how much I love you, that my blood was spilled for you. Mm-hmm. My body was broken for you. I paid this high price for you. Remember in this time that I'm gone, how much I love you. Yeah. You know, that's the Lord's Supper. So what is interesting, by the way, I got in trouble last time I taught this, by the way, of the analogy I used. I'll try not to make the same mistake, but...
send it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what the analogy was, so I can't even help you.
Yeah. I'll go ahead. Why not? I'm just kidding. So the groom in this time is preparing a house, right? What is the bride supposed to be doing in that time?
Getting ready.
Right. Mm-hmm. Getting ready. Now, how does she maintain her readiness, right? Like, how does she remain ready? Because she doesn't know when that groom is going to come pick her up. So just kind of fill you in on that. How that worked was that once everything was complete, the house is done, right? Son would go to dad and like, dad, I finished. Can I go get my bride? And he says, nope, you got to wait a little longer. I need to start getting the logistics ready for the feast. Cause it's a week long thing. This isn't just a one party day thing. Yeah. This is a week long thing. So then he starts doing the preparation for the whole wedding feast. Cause once he goes and gets her,
the whole town involved,
right? Okay. So you have to go find the bridesmaids. You have to go get the groomsmen. You have to go, you know what I mean? Like there's the planning starts. And at some point he finally says, all right, we're ready. Mm-hmm. Go get her. Right. So before we get onto that point, cause that's really the context, that point that we're about to go into the context of this parable, but this is just it's too good to just to gloss over. What is the bride doing in between that time? He's getting everything ready. She has no idea when he is coming, right? What is she supposed to do? How does she remain ready?
Remain ready? I couldn't tell you.
And we know we talked about this.
That wouldn't sound terrible.
Yeah, we talked about this last week though, about the man who, showing up not properly clothed in the wedding garment, right?
Yeah.
What does a bride wear that is necessary for a wedding?
Well, now it's a gown. I don't know if it back then.
Dress. Okay. So they had a wedding dress. And we know, you're married, I'm married. We know that when they go get fitted for that dress the first time, you don't get that dress back for about another 3 months because, you know, it takes them forever.
So it's to make them.
Right.
Yeah.
And they get it and something happens, right? That they lose a little bit of half inch off their waist or maybe gain a little half inch on their waist. Oh, it does not fit and that doesn't look the same. And it's a big crisis, right?
Yeah.
I feel like it happens in almost every single, I don't know. Anyways, the point is.
I mean, the human body doesn't stay the same all the time.
Well, especially when you're getting all stressed and planning a wedding.
Yeah, exactly.
So the point is that the bride's entire role was to mend the wedding dress. So she puts on a little weight. Loosen it up. She loses a little weight. She needs to tighten it up. It gets a little dirty. Make sure it's always washed. Because at any time that bride...
Wait, there's no way she's just wearing this wedding dress.
She's not wearing it. No.
Yeah, okay. But they're not clean, cleansed environments. Like anything could happen.
She's constantly making sure...
Their closet is also made of dirt. Like all of it's dirt.
this is what she is essentially doing. She has no idea when her groom is coming.
Mm-hmm. Would she also have to whenever, make it?
Hold on. Whenever he shows up, she needs to be able to ready to put that dress on and it fits and it looks great. So whatever's happening in between, right? She's just mending the dress to make sure it fits for whenever he comes.
Yeah,
just as we are constantly should be mending our dress to make sure we are ready, right? And this is what got me in trouble because this is what I said. I said what you don't want is that your groom shows up and you put the wedding dress on and you look like a squished up MRE bag of peanut butter, right? everything flowing out of everything, right? Like,
all right, whoever got offended by that, that's you need to look internally, not.
Oh, they were, not, very, yeah. Yeah, I heard about that one.
Go and look in the mirror and, make peace with yourself. It's okay. You'll be okay.
But that is the point though, right? You did not want to look like doo-doo.
He said, I look like peanut butter. He's like, no, I didn't. No, he didn't.
but that was really the goal, right? Is that they were supposed to be mending. And that's what we call sanctification, that we are constantly mending our dress, our garment of righteousness, right?
Okay.
So with that, right, what happens when it's ready? The Father tells the Son, it is ready, go get her, okay? This is when it really brings in this entire parable, okay? Because in that time, the bridesmaids have been included in on it. They know that it's coming soon. They just don't know exactly when.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. There's so much to this whole model. The other thing I forgot to mention is that in the time between the groom and the bride separation in that betrothal time.
Mm-hmm. While he's building the house and getting the home ready.
He chooses a helper. It's like a groomsman, essentially like his best friend or whoever, his brother. Mm-hmm. But he sends somebody to always constantly check in on the bride. And sometimes he would be like, hey, can't give her this just to remind her. Give her some of these flowers. Here's some chocolates, whatever, right? Like does she need anything? Well, they're kind of struggling. They didn't have a good harvest this year. Here, send her some bread or whatever. Because they're not allowed to see each other, but he's wanting to take care of her, right? So who does Christ send for us in this time that we're in that separation? The Holy Spirit.
Yeah, the Spirit.
The Paraclete, the Advocate, right? Mm-hmm. He is kind of like, in terms of that model, what Jesus Christ, I'm sending you the helper, a helper. Okay. That's marriage terms in John when he says, I'm sending you a helper. Mm-hmm. So the bridesmaids, the grooms are complete. At some point, the groom and the groomsmen show up. Usually it would be in the middle of the night and they kind of kick in the door like Kool-Aid guy. And they usually do this to make it fun in the middle of the night.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say, why?
And it's just to make it fun. She's sleeping and she's not expecting it.
Please don't do that. Don't come in my room.
We're already married. Thought that's too late.
We're already married.
It's like, oh, that, you know how obnoxious that would be to me? I'm like,
yeah, don't do that, please.
We are not starting this off that way. You go back out there and try again. You wait until this morning and you can cook me breakfast. Yes, and then, please, anyways.
Yeah. And then your friends can bust in the door. We can get out of here.
He could have done it any time, right? Yeah. But typically, the romantic part of it is that you do this.
You go to sleep every night in nervous anticipation.
Well, now remember this, though. Remember when Christ says,
different.
But remember Christ says, I'm coming like a
thief in the night.
Right? Okay. There's a couple things, but one of the ideas being when you're not expecting it, it's meant to be exciting. Like, I'm coming when you don't expect. We look at that, I'm like, oh no, when is he here? It's meant to be like a bride waiting in eager anticipation for her groom to show up. He's like, I'm going to show up. You're not going to expect when is he showing up? When is he showing up? Right. Getting almost anxious and like, come on,
fixing
supposed
the dress,
to build anticipation and excitement, not stress or anxiety. Right. So they would kick in the door. A groomsman would blow a trumpet.
That's even worse.
Yeah. Blow a trumpet. Then announce, here comes the bridegroom. He would go in, pick her up, carry her out and say, I'm going to take you. Right. And then from that moment on, she's like, okay, she has to get dressed in her wedding dress. And they start a march from essentially wherever she's at, probably her parents' home. And
there's
an escort too, because now that time, a week-long festivity happens, right? So in that time, though, the groomsmen are there with the horns. Remember Revelation? How does Christ come back? It says the sky opens up.
And then trumpets blow.
Here comes the bridegroom, and then he comes in, right? Now, when they're leaving, the tradition is that the bridesmaids and the groomsmen would carry torches, because it was usually at night, and they would escort the groom and the bride to where the wedding feast is going to be, right? That is where we start off with that parable. So, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of it too, but that's essentially, so you could see all those associations scripturally, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing here is there's a few, remember the five that we talked about, the no one knows the time, to keep watch, wisdom, be prepared and willing to wait, and then notice the delay, right? So it says that they were there, but the the groomsman was late, or the groom was late. So the idea was that, like, hey, he was supposed to be here, but he's not here. Like, we were told to get ready for this, mm-hmm. right? They're kind of on the inside circle, the inner circle. When is this supposed to happen? And I think there's two things that Jesus is kind of communicating, because previously in a previous parable leading into this, he had kind of told everybody, I'm going to come back sooner than you think. Mm. Here, he's also kind of now making the point, but I'm also going to be a little bit later than many of you think. There's going to be a delay. So with that in mind, they're kind of waiting, and they fall asleep, right? These, you know, 10 virgins. The thing about the bridesmaids, though, because we kind of went on the tangent about the model for, the marriage model with that, right, is that women got married pretty young. So for these 10 virgins, the context of age, you're talking about probably somebody who's between the ages of 11 and like 14 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Not always. I mean, you could have, but generally, right?
They were dying at 35. Sorry. They were dying at 35, 40 years old. Like, the whole context of the world during that time is totally different. Totally different.
Yeah,
like we're looking at it, oh my goodness, it's so young. It's like, well, they're like 25 equivalent.
Well, I'm just saying, like, is life. That you just be careful before you judge these poor 12-year-old girls for this. But
and this 12-year-old guy trying to carry her out of her bed
trying to keep his well, he wasn't necessarily 12, they were much older.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was the thing point. Too yeah, you're right.
So the thing is right, so those five elements for these, and it says that half of them were wise and half of them were foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So at the very beginning, though, Matthew kind of does this Hebraic introduction to wisdom, because Jesus says that, you know, twice, that in the end, there's going to be a separation of the wise and the foolish. What does that separation look like? So when he says that there were 10 virgins, 10 bridesmaids for this, right? In Hebrew, 10 had always kind of represented wisdom. And the reason why is because the actual word 10, like if you were to, the word for 10, mm-hmm. Means, wisdom. So mm-hmm. it's Asher, which if the thing about Hebrew, which is really cool, is that, every letter is a word, which That's means right. every word is a sentence.
Mm.
Okay. So the sentence for
this onion has layers.
What's that?
I said this onion has layers.
Right. So just stick with me for a second, okay? Yep. So the Hebrew word for 10, Asher, spelled out, is the ayin, the shin, and the resh, okay? Ayin means to see or to perceive. Shin means to consume or destroy. And resh means humility or like a bowing man, okay? Mm-hmm. So in other words, like the word 10 literally written out in terms of as a sentence
mm-hmm.
means to be consumed by humility in order to discern wisdom or mm. In order to discern or possess wisdom. So in other words, within that phrase itself, the number 10 assumes wisdom. Does that make sense? So the
it
fact
does, but I don't understand why. Is that just how,
it's like, just
how
does break. That even happen? This is a study, what they call gematria. This is a real thing within Jewish studies, is gematria, that because they also didn't have their own individual numbers. There was no mm-hmm. numeric system. So mm-hmm. the first letter in the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, is also the number one. Huh. Right? The second letter is also the number two. Then also for each one of those letters, it's its own word, right? That means something that has that a numeric value assigned. So there's a lot of, I'm telling you, there's some pretty cool stuff. So in this particular case, 10 is associated to wisdom, okay? The number 10, right? So in terms of going down the alphabet, what is the actual numeric for 10 is the Hebrew letter Yod, which is pictographically in Paleo Hebrew and literally means the working hand of God. So I guess, in other words, what it's saying is that wisdom,
mm-hmm.
And this is just how Hebraic thought, you know, through gematria and things like that, is wisdom is the ability to discern God's working hand.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so
you're able to,
that's a great way to describe that.
Yeah. You're able to look at, situations where people would have anxiety or stress or worries or fear, right? And they're able to see how God's moving in that situation. So you see an election that upsets half the country and you'd be like, nah, I could kind of see how God is moving through this and what it's driving. And here's what is creating a need for that. Now I can focus ministry to fill that void, to capture those people for the glory of Christ, right? They're able to discern and see God moving in those situations. The other thing how they also viewed wisdom was what Solomon defines as wisdom in the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, this would be worth doing a study at some point in itself, but, you know, when Solomon becomes king, you know, God pretty much says, ask me of anything and I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. You know, he could have asked, this is kind of like that genie in a bottle wish, right? Like, and what he asked for was wisdom to lead Israel. And it says that God, he says, because you have asked for wisdom and not for money and all these other things that in the flesh we'd probably want to ask for, he said, I'm going to give you that. That the people tend to kind of interpret that as meaning like, almost like prosperity gospel, like
ask and you'll
God was so impressed with his request for wisdom that he blessed him with all the other things. He gave him the women and gave him the money and gave him the fame and gave him the power. But that's not really what's happening. What did Solomon ask for? Wisdom. Mm-hmm. In order for him to receive wisdom, God had to give him every, to its max, every single thing the flesh could ever want. It said that he had over 1,000 concubines. That's a lot of women. Mm-hmm. In his time, he is considered to be, and this is by like secular historians, considered to be, depending, I guess, the list, but top five, one of the richest men who ever lived, who ever walked planet Earth.
Wow.
He had that much wealth. He was at the golden age of Christianity, power, nobody would touch him. Mm. He did not have to fear any external kingdom coming in. And he was well known. You have queens from the south coming up just to meet him because he's so renowned. He had the fame across not just his land, but everywhere, right?
Mm. At a time before any sort of technology that would have allowed that to go quickly, which just the scope of the known world at that time for him to be known throughout it, that's insane.
So,
in a way.
So he had more money than he knew what to do with. Mm-hmm. He had the fame. He had all the power. He had all the women, right? He was able to fill all the fleshly desires. Mm. Well, why? Because God was rewarding him? No. Because at the end of his life, he writes the book of Ecclesiastes. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, you know, that's all was vanity. All was vain. All was empty. It's meaningless is essentially what he says. Because he was able to get absolutely every single thing the flesh could ever want. And it led to his ultimate conclusion that this is all worthless. Mm. This is meaningless. And he said, the only thing that matters is to fear God, keep his commandments. So when he asked for wisdom, God said, I'm going to give you wisdom. And the wisdom's going to come in the fact that I'm going to give you everything you would ever want to realize how empty and fugal it is. And that the true joy, that true meaning, true purpose comes in your obedience, faithfulness, and fear of me, right? So hebraically around this concept here and what we have painted here in Matthew is in the 10 virgins is that, again, it's invoking the concept of wisdom, of the ability to see God's working hand in a situation, but also pulling in the Ecclesiastes and the wisest man to ever live, right? Bringing in Ecclesiastes and their understanding of it. So does that make sense if I lost you guys at all? Do you have a question?
No, that's super intense, and I'm liking it. Do you have any thoughts, though?
No, I'm good.
Okay, so as we keep working through this then, so just keep that in mind about from the very beginning, this concept of wisdom that you have wise and foolish ones, right? If we read in verse 3, it says, the foolish ones took their lamps but not take any oil with them. Mm-hmm. The wise ones, however, took oil and jars along with their lamps. They didn't just bring the lamps. They brought jars to associate the lamp just in case, right? Mm-hmm. The wisdom in those bridesmaids was that not just that I need a lamp with oil on it, but the wisdom of being prepared for delay.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah.
So they were prepared for a delay. The other ones were not.
Mm-hmm.
That is what that's kind of showing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They had wisdom. Hey, be prepared just in case he's late. Because we talked about that procession, right? Once he kicks in the door, like the Kool-Aid guy, blows the trumpet, here comes the bridegroom, right? They do the procession. The wedding was always surrounding how central and significant it is, right? Everything was about the honor of the bride and the groom.
Mm-hmm.
So to have your lamps burn out as you do that procession would have brought great embarrassment to the groom and the bride and would have been brought a lot of dishonor. This is a very true statement as well when we talked to about the wedding in Cana and Jesus' first miracle.
Yeah, with the wine.
With the wine. Mm-hmm. It's this very same principle. This one can almost be worse in the sense that from the very get-go, kick in the door, it's like, I mean, maybe the only other one worse would be kick in the door and the trumpet doesn't work, right? Like, but the trumpet works. He picks her up.
And kick in the door and the door doesn't break.
That's exactly my vision.
but in this case, it's a very beginning, right? This is just retrieving the bride and the lamps burned out. Like we haven't even started the wedding banquet yet and we've been dishonored.
Mm.
It would have been like, it would have created gossip for decades. It would have brought tons of shame, right? So I think one of the important things to remember about this then, because a lot of people like to associate the oil and the lamps to like faith. Oh, they just didn't have enough faith. They didn't have enough faith because oil often is in the Old Testament is often associated to faith, right? So when you anoint somebody, when you're trying to pray over and heal somebody, you'd often anoint them with oil because that represents to them, like it's something tangible you could touch to represent faith, okay. Right?
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the case for this parable. One, it's a different kind of oil that they're referring to. But second, this is all surrounding the honor of the bride and the bridegroom.
Yeah. This means you can clearly read that it's coming from the context of a wedding ceremony, or so, not a king being anointed. Like we're talking in the parable about a wedding ceremony. So don't bring that a different anchor in, like use the parable itself to anchor.
The more relevant anchor is the cultural context of a wedding, right? Yeah. So notice that the wise ones both show up. Wise and the foolish ones show up. The wise ones brought an extra jar of oil with them just in case he was late. There wasn't a plan to be late, but he ended up being late, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this again goes back to the whole Hebraic concept of wisdom and like another good example for like 10, how many commandments were given?
10 commandments,
right? Which is a summary, a completion of the law, right?
Okay.
Which that are actually like 613
laws,
But yeah. the 10 commandments are the summation, right? The law of God has also been considered, has been called the wisdom of God, the knowledge of God, right? Mm-hmm. So all that's going through, the wise ones brought the lamps, extra jars along with the lamps. The foolish ones did not. Now it says that the bridegroom was a long time in coming and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. So just one piece with that. A lot of people like to make a lot of the fact that they fell asleep. There's nothing negative. Both the wise and the foolish bridesmaids fell asleep. Okay, that's not...
Oh, they all became drowsy. Yeah, they all were drowsy.
Yeah, they were all drowsy and fell asleep.
Yeah.
A lot of people like to turn this into being a whole other thing about rapture doctrine and things like that.
You got to be prepared. You have to always be ready. You got to be awake.
Right? And then when you're associating with faith, and then it's just like there's really no negative connotation. They were both drowsy, both fell asleep, right?
The wise and the unwise.
Right, both. Yep. So that's not really the big thing. The big thing is that at midnight, the cry rang out, here comes the bridegroom. Come out to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish one said to the wise, give us some of your oil. Our lamps are going out. Right? So I would just say this is that it sounds kind of odd. Well, we'll just keep reading. No, they replied. There may be enough for both. There may not be enough for both us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some yourselves.
It's midnight, isn't it?
Well, if you keep reading, right, what it says, while they're on their way to buy oil, the bridegroom arrived. went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. So it was closed, first of all, right? So because it's midnight, they can't find oil.
Yeah.
Well, if they've been waiting a while, let's say they've been waiting like 6 hours because it says it was delayed and they slept.
No, it says at midnight, the cry rang out. It's in there.
What?
Yeah, at midnight,
I thought that's cry when the helper came.
Beginning of verse 6.
Yeah, at midnight, the cry rang out. Here comes the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. So that's when all the virgins woke up and went out to meet him, right? Yeah.
So I just find it funny. They're like, no, go buy some oil.
Well, it's
like,
right. Where? It seems harsh, right?
Yeah.
But there's actually wisdom in this, okay? The reason why we think it's harsh is like, well, shouldn't they be sharing? They don't want to share their faith. Well, that's not what the oil represents. The oil represents honor. And what did they say? They said, if we give you our oil, then the chances is that we all run out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In other words, it is better
which would be worse
that five of us have our lamps and it remains lighting with a torch, and that it lasts for the whole procession to get us to the banquet, than to run the possibility of having 10 torches, but they all burn out by the time we go and we dishonor them. So it's actually an act of wisdom because they're able to discern, right, the reality that how much they have in terms of quantity, that if I do that risk, I risk dishonoring
completely
the groom and the bride, right? So this is all, again, so you see how they're starting to tie. Mm. It's all centered around the honor of the bridegroom and the groom and having the wisdom to kind of navigate now a problem.
So it's not the honor of the individual bridesmaid. It's not about them. It's about, let's look at this holistically. We need to be making sure we're honoring the bride and the bridegroom.
Correct.
And let's not completely jack this up, even though one person in this collective did jack it up or possibly is going to jack
it up. Well, five of them did. Instead,
half the collective has jacked it up.
Yeah, the five were idiots, right? By the way, I thought it was this interesting too. In that procession, it was your religious and legal duty to join in on the procession if you saw one.
That's so cool.
So I thought it was interesting because when I was in Israel, we saw a procession from a distance,
mm-hmm.
but you saw everybody coming in. And I thought this was planned. Like, I thought it was just like a, and then our guy was like, no, they don't probably even know them. Because remember, this is a communal thing.
Yeah. Huh.
It was their duty to join in on the procession and honor them that way. So this whole thing is about this big anticipation and this honor for both the bride and the bridegroom. So what is the parousia going to be like? Everything that is surrounding it is the honor in terms of the second coming of Christ, it's mm-hmm. going to surround the honor of the bride and the bridegroom. And those who have the wisdom to discern what is happening to make it there to honor them in that time. Okay, so does that make sense so far?
Yeah, it does. I'm loving this. Okay. Absolutely.
So just one thing about that, though. They were expected to be ready to honor the bride and the groom, right? To fulfill the purpose that they were assigned within the functions of the wedding.
Yes.
They were expected to do this, right? It was also a pretty big deal to take place in this procession. It was like an honor, kind of like what we talked mm-hmm. about last week for being invited to the king's wedding banquet, right? That's a huge honor. It is a huge honor to be selected to be one of the bridesmaids to participate.
Yeah, because you said in the beginning that the groom's family is like planning all of this stuff out and it's taking, you know, months and to prep it all and get it all together. It's like, this is your role in this very large event.
Right. And a very important one to honor the bride and the bridegroom. And yeah. I always just wondered what some of those conversations would be like, though. Like, wait, Meredith is one of the 10 virgins? Okay, Meredith.
No one vetted that resume.
I don't know. But no, it was meant to be an honor, right? But they were supposed to be ready. This didn't surprise them, nor did their expectation of when he showed up surprise them. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm saying this is that you should not be surprised when Christ comes back and then the way he starts reigning and ruling, this shouldn't be like, oh, I had no idea. Mm. We are already introduced to that kingdom now. We already know the way he wants things to run because we're supposed to be the ones who are influencing that in society, right?
Great commission.
Right. The idea that he shows up when we don't know when, mm-hmm. but that we don't know what our expectation is going to be how he's going to rule, just hold on to that, because in the end here, he says something very harsh and scary to the foolish bridesmaids, which we'll get there in a second. But I would just also say, though, that in this time, like at the heart of our faith is this eager anticipation that one day Christ will return. And by that extension, we will be vindicated, right? He's going to set all things right. We'll live under his reign. But it's hard to be vindicated of a message that you've never shared to people. You know what I mean?
I don't think I know the definition of vindicated.
Vindicated, it's like to be proven right, right? So you're like, you're saying Christ is king and he's coming back. You know, repent. Come into the invitation, into the kingdom. Make him Lord of your life. And he's going to come back. And when he comes back, if you don't belong to him, it's going to turn out really bad for you, but it's going to be great for those who belong to him, right? Mm-hmm. And people may just laugh at you. They might mock you. They'll treat you like they treated Jesus himself, right? Potentially. The very least, they may just think you're an idiot. They'll call you an idiot. You know what I mean? And I don't care who you are. People want acceptance from other people, right? Nobody, it would drive both of you crazy if I went home tonight thinking both of you guys are idiots. I don't. I'm saying.
I mean, if I didn't know you thought that, then it wouldn't hurt me at all.
But if I did, right? You know what I'm saying? It would drive you crazy that why does he think that? Why does he think we're idiots? It would bother you.
Yeah.
It would seriously bother, just as it would bother me, right? It bothers people because that is natural for us. So the fact that you get mocked and maybe made fun of however, at some point though, you're going to be proven right. You know what I'm saying? You're going to be vindicated. You have to be ready for that, though. I think one of the things with the foolish ones talking about those days is that if there is nothing of you for you to be vindicated of, there's probably a problem. You may not be as ready as you think, right? It's like, oh, the sky's opening up. Oh, I should probably tell my children about Jesus. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, no.
You know, you ran out of oil, right? I think that's but the wise, don't miss though, the wise bridesmaids' refusal to share the oil had ultimately saved the banquet. Mm. And it was keeping into the highest honor to the bride and the groom, right? The foolish bridesmaids, they were unprepared, and it was a great dishonor to the bride and the bridesmaid. Mm. But the wise ones, by not sharing, ultimately saved the wedding. You see what I'm saying? The other ones risked it. And
how does that translate for us, though?
I would say...
Yeah, I was going to say, when do we not share?
I would say, in the context of honor, how many things do we do or say that could risk us dishonoring Christ? I don't mean just in terms of behavior, but in terms of impression, right? So the way things are perceived. Someone can perceive, isn't he a Christian? Should Christians be going to places like that or watching things like that or listening to music like that, right? And is it, are you becoming close to potentially vastly dishonoring your Lord, right? Or in your wisdom and discernment, are you able to sift through and be able to decide this is what, this is what will honor him? And I safeguard that, even at the cost of not sharing my oil with others. Even though, because ultimately what ends up happening is the foolish bridesmaids are dishonored, right? In their dishonor, they themselves ultimately were dishonored. They were not allowed into the banquet hall. You see what I'm saying? And that may be hard for some people to do. It was like, well, but what about love them? Aren't we supposed to love them and compromise and maybe run the risk that we're going to dishonor Christ by doing that out of love, right? And I think one of the central things is you're to love him before you love anybody else.
Okay, I see that.
You're to honor him before you honor anybody else. And I think for many, that's hard to do. It's hard sometimes even in marriage, right? Marriage is supposed to be the most intimate, personal relationship you have on this planet and in mm-hmm. your life, the only other one that trumps it is your relationship with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you're in a situation where you have, in order to honor your spouse, you have to dishonor Christ? Sometimes you're in a situation where you feel like in the world would justify or vindicate you in certain actions towards your spouse, but in order to be honoring to Christ, you have to choose forgiveness and grace and mercy. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because honoring Christ is above any other sort of honor out there. And even though there are essentially, the bridesmaids were saying this, risk dishonoring the bride and the bridegroom in order to honor us. And what they decided is that we choose to safely make sure we honor the bride and the bridegroom at the and my risk will be you are dishonored.
Mm.
And that's exactly what happens, right? Because if you keep going, it says, but while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others also came. Lord, Lord, they said, open the door for us. But he replied, truly, I tell you, I do not know you. You know, Jesus says that three different times in three different stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Old Testament often describes God's relationship with Israel as one between a bride and a bridegroom, right? The Qumran community, so that's like where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, where John the Baptist probably spent a lot of his time. The Qumran texts also show that there was a common teaching of associating the bridegroom to the Messiah, right? That Jesus does ultimately associate to himself and us, the church. So this idea that I don't know you, you know, in Matthew 7, for example, he says it there too. I feel like this is one of the scariest passages in all of the Gospels. And the fact that it's repeated multiple times makes it even more scary. It's emphasized multiple times in Matthew. Last week we talked about the difference. It's not just about responding to the invitation, but being properly clothed, right? For this one, the first question is, do you know Jesus? But the second equally important question is, does Jesus know you?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in this particular case, in all these cases, they all knew Jesus. They knew who he was. That's not what got them out. What kept them out is that Jesus didn't know who they were. And it is a very important question for us to ask. I know Jesus, and I study Jesus, and I know who Jesus is. But does Jesus know me? And how does he know me? Would he know me through serving, not just his church, but people? Does he know me from the time I spend in prayer?
Mm.
Does he know me in the times that I am studying scripture, but reflectively and like, you know, Lord, talk to me here, meet with me here, show me something here. Or am I studying to prove a point, or, you know what I'm saying? So I could write that that Facebook post that justifies a political position. You know what I'm saying? It's not just do you know Jesus, but does Jesus know you? And it's a very important question because these bridesmaids, the wise ones, did all they could to make sure and save not just the banquet, but honored the bride and the bridegroom. The foolish ones played with fire on it, and they got, as they come knocking, trying to come in late, he says, you're not allowed in. I don't know you.
Yeah.
And you did not choose to honor me, right? And your laziness, there's plenty of opportunity for them to go out and get more oil. It wasn't until he showed up that they wanted it. You know what I mean? So
okay.
He concludes it then with this. Therefore, keep watch because you do not know the day or the hour. So just to kind of conclude that, right? Because what about the wisdom piece in all this, right? So we see the honor, but there's also this huge wisdom thing, right? Wisdom is directly synonymous with readiness in this parable. Okay? Wisdom is directly synonymous with readiness. To fear God, to be humble, to be able to discern God's working hand in situations, all to the point of not just making you ready, but making you aware, right? So I think one of the things that may be implicit in this point that we may miss with that concept of wisdom and how it paints the story is one where, all right, the bridegroom is late, but why is he late? Well, yeah, guys, but I know, but they said that they were waiting for two more cows to come in from the countryside to slaughter for the feast. They were on their way, but they hadn't arrived yet. So they're probably just waiting on the cows. The cows are on their way. And I know they were waiting for a couple more jars of wine to come in from the countryside. They thought they had enough, but then this other side of the family decided to show up and there was another batch that was bad, right? They were able to understand and see what's going and discerning a situation to understand why are things happening that way, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And they were prepared for it. The foolish ones weren't discerning what was going on, so they weren't able to also be prepared for it. You know what I mean? So wisdom comes in the discernment of being able to see God move in those situations and having the humility and the readiness to be prepared in them.
I think it's also important to note that wisdom comes from experience. So maybe some of those five have experienced a wedding gone wrong where they didn't have enough oil, and so they knew to bring the additional oil. Wisdom also can be born from asking questions, like just understanding enough that you don't know and to ask the questions. Because if those five had spoken to those other five or spoken to someone else, like, hey, what should I do to do this right? Someone may have told them, hey, bring some extra oil because things may go wrong. Things may be delayed. You need to be prepared for X, Y, and Z. So don't sleep on that. You may not have all of the knowledge. You may not have all of the wisdom now, but through your study, through your asking those questions to the minister, to the pastors and faith leaders in your life, and then doing the work and wrestling with it, that's how you gain that wisdom, or that's a way you can gain it.
Yeah, I would also like to. There's a difference between wisdom and intelligence too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, there's smart people, but they're fools.
Absolutely.
There's wise people, right? The ability to discern and see what God is doing, to perceive and understand those situations.
That's what I mean. Like, to be able to know enough to understand that you need to ask more is still a form of wisdom. Like,
right.
I'm just trying to highlight that those five may not be all the same level of intelligence and not smart and not have the same experiences. It could have just been that they were aware enough of what was going on to ask for some additional external advice. And someone told them, you probably should bring some extra oil, just in case.
Yeah. I think another big piece out of this parable too, with the foolish ones, the difference between the two, when you look characteristically at them, is that the foolish ones didn't take their job serious enough. Mm-hmm. So, because notice at the time of the parousia, when Christ comes back, when the groom returns, is it ever painted as us working? What ministry and labor are we doing?
After he comes.
When he comes back, right?
When he comes back. I think we're just worshiping. We're just with him.
We're supposed to be working now. At that time, it's us in fellowship and community, right? It doesn't mean that we're not going to work when he comes back and he's reigning. I'm saying, but it's meant, we're not supposed to start working once he comes back. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be working now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's the time that we actually celebrate together, right? And we are honored together in glory, right? That's when we're vindicated and all the, but, what leads to that, though, is taking the job that we were giving now serious.
Mm.
And the foolish ones just didn't take it serious enough.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, yeah, I mean, I'll be a bridesmaid. I'll be a Christian. Yeah, I'll be a believer. Okay, well, you need to, our goal is to honor the groom. When the groom comes, like, our whole job in this is to make sure they are honored. Okay, yeah, I'll be
there.
I'll be a bridesmaid. Sure. I'll honor them. Right, and they show up with the lamp, no extra oil. Hey, you don't have an extra jar? What if they're late?
I thought you were going to say double.
Right, right? You know, it's like, yeah. So it's like the thing with the fools is that they didn't also realize how important of a job they had. They weren't able to see the fallacies and the way that they had approached that job, or they just didn't care enough. So, you know, you. Don't be a fool, right? Understand that you were saved to a purpose. and take that job serious. Don't just sit on it and treat it like it's a fantasy football league team. You know what I'm saying? Like it is far, a fool does that.
Yeah.
You know, never thought I could say that, but don't be an idiot for Jesus.
Say yeah. whatever you want. It's not in church. We're in a podcast in my office right now.
Yeah. Well, but did you guys have any questions? I mean, I think it's a pretty straightforward parable. Once you understand that it's anchored around honor and the mm-hmm. wisdom to discern it. Right. I would just say one of the big takeaways from it, though, that you could give for encouragement for people, though, is that there are many wise people. There are many believers who want to honor Christ. And, you know, again, sometimes we get sleepy, we get exhausted, we get tired, but being committed to that, right? But, you know, there are many people who want that wisdom or want to honor, they just don't know how. Right, so there's people like, I don't want to be a fool, but I know I am a fool. You're actually probably more wise than you think you are.
Yeah, to be able to recognize that you need to ask some questions is a right. form of wisdom.
Right. People like, who think they're really wise can tend to be the biggest fools of all because they don't have the humility to be able to discern. They then try to interpret every situation through the lens of their own understanding. Yeah. They think themselves
to be
wise. And
they think that's good enough.
And that they get caught up in all these things that they ended up, you know what I'm saying? Humility is, there are those who are very humble and those who are very, who could also be very wise, but it's almost in their humility, they feel like they're undeserving to do their job. Like, I shouldn't even be a bridesmaid. And then they don't do the job, right? Like, the thing in the collection of this is you need the humility, the love and desire to honor the groom and the willingness to do it.
I remember you telling us before that no one is qualified to profess Christ. We're called to do it, but no one's really qualified to do it.
If you feel like I would, but I don't feel like I'm ready or I don't feel like I am qualified to do it, well, welcome to the club because nobody is. But again, when we say be ready, it's be ready for his parousia, not be ready to work then. You're supposed to be working now.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Be ready for when he returns. You're like, finally, I've been honoring you. I'm vindicated. But I think one of the things that distracts us over time, in our ability to stay aware and to be ready is that the delay itself just seems so long. And it's just like, how long? Like I go through these modes of being very highly motivated and go, 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 go. And then there's times where I'm like, I just don't want to do nothing. Maybe I should quit. Maybe I should leave. And, you know, like,
yeah.
And you just kind of go through like the delay in itself is hard, but why does he wait? And, you know, the ability to the wisdom and the discernment to see, that's because there's still plenty of people to be saved, which means I still have a lot of work to do and you do too. And I'm not going to take that flippantly, right? I'm going to try to be a wise bridesmaid and take that job serious, you know? The prayer would be, Lord, let us honor Christ with our lives. Give us the wisdom to execute that ministry. Let us be ready for your return. Let us be humble enough to commit, and execute that ministry. You know, because again, the last thing I want is to toil and all this is in vain for me to ultimately show up at the end for Christ to say, I don't know you. So take this stuff serious. Take the faith serious. Take in your Bible. Spend time with Christ. Ask for clarification on calling if you're not clear on it. Ask for clarification on what your job should be doing and ask yourself, am I taking this serious enough? Let us not be flippant with it.
Yeah. I'd like to try and tie up really what I got out of a lot of what you said today and really just hone in on that, the point that the bridesmaids' actions were honoring despite them hurting essentially or potentially hurting one or two others. So when I think of that, it's just there are times that I can remember where I would do things that dishonored the Lord to honor someone because I didn't want to hurt them or I didn't want to embarrass them. So you have to just be careful of that. Be careful that your actions to save one, that it may dishonor Christ. But I also don't want you to take it so far where you use this as an excuse to not love and to not go to those that need to hear the gospel, not go to those that, because you're afraid of associating with people like that. Jesus associated with all sorts of people to tell them what they needed to hear so that they would accept him and follow him, right? So it's not an excuse to treat others outside of how Jesus treated others.
And you know, because you say, hey, wolves like to dress in sheep's clothing, right? We talked about the parable of the wheat and the weeds.
Yeah, even amongst the church, you may.
Right, the weeds grow up among the wheat. It's what often happens is you say, be careful, there are weeds in the church. And sometimes they expose themselves in situations and you realize, you know, that you can call it that, right? This is sin. This is not okay. This needs to be fixed or you're right. Follow the whole Matthew 18 model. And then people will come back like, you're judging. You're judging me. Why are you judging? You Pharisee, you're part of the law. And it's like, no, there's so much more to that. Because part of law is accountability, or I'm sorry, love is accountability. Yeah. And, but to your same That's point right. though, this also is a community of faith and we're supposed to be helping each other. So it's not simply like, hey, I just got to worry about me and my honor. And, as long as I'm good
yeah.
and willing to honor Christ, because also note, this was a communal honoring, right?
Yeah.
If only one of those lamps were lit and all the other ones were out.
Yeah, you didn't completely
That's still kind of embarrassing, right?
Yeah.
So it is a communal thing that you have to still do together.
Yeah.
But you have to discern the situation to say what is the best way to honor Christ in this.
And I think that that's...
No situation is ever the same.
I think that's super important to remember as well that judgment is not on you. Judgment belongs to God, right? It is not our role to separate, like we talked before, the wheat from the weeds. And remember, so discernment is not the ability to separate the wheat from the weeds. The discernment is to be able to see God's working hand.
Yes.
So I want you to make sure you do this as you go throughout the week. And man, I go through this process so much because I have to edit all these episodes and it's just constantly going on in my head. But reflect on your actions and relationships and apply that discernment. Like look to see God's working hand in your life and in the things you're doing now. And if you're seeing that you're doing things that may be dishonoring to God, and you don't know, ask the question. Do the work, study, wrestle with it, and ask yourself those questions. And if there are things you are doing in your life that is hurting your witness and that is dishonoring to the Lord, make the change. You can only do that through study, through asking those questions and wrestling with the faith. So it's something I'm still working through. It's something we're all should be working through, and it's a continuous process as we go through this life until we're ultimately united with our Father in heaven. So we hope you'll continue to join us each week for Real Bible Stories, and we want to continue to study with you and have this time with you each week. So if you're in the Twin Palms area and you want to meet us, hang out, and come hang out with us at church, just come down to Palms Baptist Church, and we'd love to talk with you, lay your hands on you, pray with you, whatever you need. Just want to say that we love you. And we're all going through it together. But this is the process. This is the process. So I hope to see you next Monday. Hope you all have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in to Real Bible Stories. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to leave a review, share, and subscribe to be notified each week when we upload new episodes. Real Bible Stories is produced in partnership with Palms Church in 29 Palms, California. If you would like more information or want to check out archived sermons and Bible studies, please check out the church website at palmsbaptistchurch.com or check them out on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. Real Bible Stories can be found wherever podcasts are found. Thank you again, and we will see you next week.